have been telling us that everything was safe and you think we will look on you as gods, but now we have ended up with a fiasco. The ministers and scientific centers have been working outside of any controls. Throughout the entire system, there has reigned a spirit of servility, fawning, clannishness and persecution of independent thinkers, window dressing, and personal and clan ties between leaders. It was akin to Khrushchev's secret speech, except instead of denouncing Stalin, Gorbachev was denouncing central planning itself. That September, eager to get things back on track, Gorbachev wrote to Reagan suggesting a quick one-on-one meeting to prepare the ground for a Washington summit. This was going to be the meeting before the big meeting, possibly with only our foreign ministers present. Gorbachev proposed either Iceland, halfway between the two nations, or Thatcher's home turf of London as the two possible locations for the get-together. Reagan agreed to meet in Iceland. The two men picked the date and the location, and only then bothered to let the Icelandic government know that, within 2 weeks, Reykjavik would be hosting an event of historic proportions. Finding lodging for the political teams, Reagan and Gorbachev both decided in the end to bring an entourage, would be difficult. Finding lodging for the international media outlets on the small island nation would prove close to impossible. Reykjavik city administrator offered the best welcome he could to the horde of journalists flying into his city. "We are the descendants of the most boring people in Europe, the Norwegians," he explained, "and the drinkingest, the Irish." Author Suzanne Massey taught President Reagan the Russian rhyme "Doveryay, ne proveryay," which means trust but verify. It was one of two slogans that guide his thinking in negotiations with the USSR. The two countries would have a basis of trust in their discussions and agreements, but this needed to be supplemented by some mechanism to ensure that each party was holding on to its commitments. Alongside this was the concept of peace through strength, akin to Teddy Roosevelt's "speak softly and carry a big stick." It was a lot easier to fight for peace when one is prepared for the opposite. In Reagan's view, it wasn't his famous charm that was crucial to getting the Russians to negotiate, but the U.S. military spending, which had more than doubled since he had assumed office. As Reagan sarcastically put it, "Trust and understanding, it is said, will lead to arms control." Hearing people say that is like meeting grown-ups who still believe in the tooth fairy. Gorbachev could not commit to an escalating arms race, even if he had wanted one. Yet another one of Reagan's jokes illustrated the problem that Gorbachev was facing as the president discussed the plight of the consumer in the Soviet Union. You have to wait 10 years there for delivery after you order an automobile, and so a fellow had finally gotten the money together and was going to buy an automobile. Only about 1 out of 7 families have them in that country. And he went through all the paperwork and everything and finally signed the last paper, laid down his money, and then the man behind the counter said, "Come back in 10 years and get your automobile." And the man said, "Morning or afternoon?" And the fellow behind the counter says, "Well, what difference does it make 10 years from now?" And he said, "Well, the plumber's coming in the morning." The Marxist argument was that without capitalists appropriating the workers' surplus value for themselves in the form of profit, a socialist command economy could produce enough for everyone at a fraction of the workload. Almost 70 years after Lenin seized power, few continued to make that claim. American experts had argued whether the USSR was spending 9 to 11% of their GDP on the military, or if it was close to 11 to 13%. The actual figure was somewhere between 30 and 40%. To provide perspective, the United States was spending 35% of its GDP on the military for a brief period during the height of World War II. The Soviets were spending around that much every single year, a clearly unsustainable cost that would be almost impossible to increase. Gorbachev would admit as much to Reagan. "The U.S. has money and can do things that the Soviets cannot do." As the two world leaders sat down in Reykjavik to discuss matters, a couple of things quickly became obvious. First, both were excited about the possibility of making progress toward a nuclear-free world and a better relationship with one another. Second, Reykjavik wasn't just some precursor to a later major summit as they had originally planned. This was possibly a once-in-a-lifetime meeting for both men, and they were both determined to make the most of it. Reagan's proposal at Reykjavik was a fairly straightforward one. As he recalled, "I proposed that in the first phase of our plan to eliminate our nuclear weapons, each of us would scrap 50% of our missiles while continuing research on a missile defense system. If and when the SDI reached the point at which it could be tested, the United States would permit Soviet observers at the tests, and if the test demonstrated that the system was effective, and once we had scrapped 50% of our missiles, each of us would destroy the balance of our missiles, and both countries would share all SDI technology. At the 10-year point, when all ballistic missiles were eliminated, each of us would deploy the SDI system simultaneously." As Reagan's deputy director of the CIA put it, there appeared to be only two people on the planet who actually thought SDI would work, Reagan and Gorbachev. Nevertheless, it remained a sticking point throughout their entire negotiations in Iceland. Gorbachev found it absolutely unbelievable that Reagan would share SDI technology with the USSR. Indeed, as Reagan's director of the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, Ken Edelman, admitted, there was no way he ever would. Reagan kept insisting on the need for SDI by using a metaphor, pointing out that when the use of chemical weapons was prohibited after World War I, the world did not reject gas masks. They were the guarantee of our protection against such a weapon in case someone decided to use it. Over and over, Gorbachev brought up reasons why SDI was unacceptable to the Russians, and Reagan being Reagan, over and over, the president brought up his gas masks metaphor. That's the 10th time you talked about gas masks, Gorbachev eventually snapped, only exaggerating slightly. Reagan was a smooth politician when he wanted to be, but Gorbachev was a Russian, and he had no shortage of cunning at his disposal. He agreed with Reagan about reducing and possibly eliminating not only nuclear missiles, but nuclear weapons. He agreed with Reagan about the need for transparency and mutual verification. When Reagan pointed out he couldn't withdraw nukes from Europe and leave them vulnerable to invasion, Gorbachev volunteered to massively reduce conventional forces. I couldn't believe what was happening, Reagan thought. We were getting amazing agreements. I thought we were in complete agreement and were going to achieve something remarkable. Gorbachev sat there and gave Reagan everything he wanted. They ignored the scheduled noon deadline and kept working. It was then, after hours of breakthroughs in the negotiations, that Gorbachev reminded Reagan of just who he was dealing with. He leaned forward, smiled at the president, and said, "This all depends, of course, on you giving up SDI." What was supposed to be a frank discussion between the president and Gorbachev has come to acquire an almost mythical status within conservative circles. Reagan at Reykjavik is shorthand for holding fast to one's principles when everything is on the line politically. Early in his administration, Reagan had famously worked together with Democrat Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill and conservative Democrats to reform the tax code. When he came into office, the top marginal rate was 70%, meaning the federal government alone took 70% of any money an individual earned over $108,300, in addition to the rest of a person's earnings being taxed at lower rates. Reagan left office with close to a flat tax, with no federal taxes for individual income up to $17,850 and 28% taken out of any income after that. But Reagan never had a Republican House majority, and by the sixth year of his presidency, there was little appetite among congressional Democrats for Reagan's conservative proposals. If he was going to have a win in his second term, it would have to take place in terms of foreign relations. All he had to do was give up his silly SDI program, which at best was many years from being technologically feasible. He just had to compromise. Reagan refused. As expected, the Democrats savaged the president, with Senator Al Gore speaking for many and calling the summit a complete fiasco. Nor was the reaction from his allies much better. In many ways, Reykjavik became for Reagan what the Falklands were for Thatcher. And just as with the Falklands, Thatcher and Reagan once again did not see eye to eye. My own reaction when I heard how far the Americans had been prepared to go was as if there had been an earthquake beneath my feet, wrote Thatcher. The whole system of nuclear deterrence, which had kept the peace for 40 years, was close to being abandoned. Behind closed doors, Thatcher even began to say that the Americans were crazy. Gorbachev had it a little easier. As Reagan once pointed out to him, there was a large asymmetry between the Russian and the American systems. A Russian and American were arguing about our two countries. The American said, "Look, I can walk into the Oval Office, I can pound the president's desk, and I can say, 'Mr. President, I don't like the way you are running our country.'" And the Russian said, "I could do that." The American said, "You can?" He said, "Yes, I can go into the Kremlin, to the General Secretary's office, pound his desk, and say, 'Mr. General Secretary, I don't like the way President Reagan is running his country.'" Gorbachev didn't have to deal with being publicly denigrated by his media. Right after the summit ended, he savaged Reagan to the Politburo, attacking the president's extreme primitivism, caveman cast of mind, and intellectual feebleness. Though he didn't have to deal with media critics, Gorbachev still had to deal with his problems at hand, namely, what was going to be done about the threat of nuclear war and the Cold War more broadly. Maybe SDI didn't have to be such a sticking point. On the one hand, if SDI didn't work as planned, the large amount of money the United States committed to research, including some for UK companies to encourage support from Thatcher, could surely result in some strong discoveries that would benefit Americans, possibly in defiance of agreements like the ABM Treaty. On the other hand, the Russians soon realized that a working SDI could be outmaneuvered at a fraction of the cost. All they would have to do was to fire a huge number of dummy missiles, making it functionally impossible to shoot them all down. But this was an escalation toward a nuclear exchange, the exact opposite direction from where Gorbachev wanted to go. It is almost impossible to convey to a free people what it is like to live in a totalitarian dictatorship, but Gorbachev had seen it firsthand. He saw it and lived it his entire life, and he saw the alternative. He saw that he could do business with the President of the United States and with the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and the advantages that a more liberal society could bestow on its citizens. Indeed, early in his career, he already had more firsthand experience with Western democracies than most of the Soviet leadership at the time, having visited Italy, Belgium, the Netherlands, France, and West Germany in the early 1970s as a member of Soviet delegations. As he put it, "My previous belief in the superiority of socialist democracy over the bourgeois system was shaken as I observed the functioning of civic society and the different political systems. People there lived in better conditions and were better off than in our country." Gorbachev had also spent a week in Canada in 1983 as part of the Central Committee Secretariat for Agriculture, studying farming techniques from a nation with a similar climate. He had learned a great deal due to frank discussions with Soviet Ambassador to Canada Alexander Yakovlev, who had lived there for a decade and developed a good understanding of Western political economies. All these lessons taught Gorbachev that liberalization was key for the well-being of the citizens of the USSR. Early in 1986, Gorbachev had given a speech to the Communist Party Congress, announcing a policy of perestroika, rebuilding, in conjunction with the concept of glasnost, or openness. He saw that honest conversations with Reagan and Thatcher, where all parties involved made plain their concerns and goals, allowed for, if not mutual agreement, at the very least mutual trust and respect. Gorbachev did not regard the Soviet Union as it currently stood to be either desirable or sustainable, and the man who occupied Stalin's chair was in a position to do something about it. Naturally, this new liberalization of information met with no small measure of hostility from entrenched bureaucrats and party officials, as Gorbachev realized the removal of the curtain of secrecy was tantamount to a death sentence for some organizations. Their uselessness would be exposed. And the ideologists, who stood watch over the system, assumed, and rightly so, that truth would undermine faith in our system. Not just the emperor, but the entire court would be found to have no clothes. But once the floodgates were open, little could stop them. Revelations about Soviet labor camps and Stalin's collusion with Hitler became topics of public discourse, eventually culminating in the serialization of the Gulag Archipelago in the major Russian periodical Novy Mir. Even Vladimir Nabokov's extremely controversial novel Lolita was cleared for publication by a Russian court. As historian Michael Dobbs pointed out, the rewriting of Soviet history became so extensive that Soviet secondary schools were obliged to cancel all history exams pending the release of new textbooks. Certain Western shows began to appear on Soviet television. While pro-Western propaganda was not first on the television agenda, in a sense, everything foreign in the Soviet Union could be seen as a form of propaganda. Capitalist propaganda is anything which gives a good impression of capitalism as a way of life. Anything that sells people the idea that life in America is good and that people are free and happy would, in a way, be capitalist propaganda. Programs like the drama masterpiece Dallas and its lobotomized ripoff Dynasty were almost entirely apolitical. If taken literally, the storylines about the lives of the most wealthy capitalist elites and their amoral behavior could be considered as anti-capitalist propaganda. Yet in a country where politics pervaded quite literally everything, the shows did more to influence Russian opinion than any American newscast ever could. Because such programs were very clearly not designed to have a political message, that implied that their content was somewhat true to life. Viewers saw for themselves what life was like abroad, and not just for the wealthy, but for their staffs. It was by watching the maids of the rich that those behind the Iron Curtain could see how the working poor lived overseas. They saw that they owned automobiles, and they did not have to worry about their phones being tapped. They did not live in terror of their employers. They did not have to worry about cold weather, not in their fur coats, or about food. They were never shown waiting in line for food, or even being hungry. Marx's worldview was heavily informed as a 19th century reaction to the Industrial Revolution. Dobbs explained the consequences of decades of the Soviet focus on industrialization at the expense of raising people's quality of life. By the early 80s, the Soviet Union led the world in such basic economic indices as the production of iron, coal, timber, and cement. It boasted the world's biggest hydroelectric dam, largest steel factory, heaviest tractors, most powerful rockets. At the same time, industry was unable to produce a decent razor blade or meet the demand for toilet paper. As Gorbachev admitted, the arguments of our ideologists regarding the creation of the basis of socialism, its complete and final victory, and finally, the construction of a developed social society, which were purely apologetic and scholastic, could no longer satisfy anyone. Much of the Russian population was living under a system of public lies and private truths, wherein they smiled and nodded in public spaces about the gloriousness of the Soviet system before coming home and dropping the whole facade. Gorbachev's reforms also allowed for increased contact with relatives abroad. A woman could contact her cousin living in America, saying that her neighbor was thinking of visiting in the fall, only to be told that the following spring would make for much better weather. The American understood that there was no neighbor and that the woman was asking about herself, and the government agent listening in on the phone understood coded too. Everyone knew the coded language, but increasingly, no one cared enough to do anything about it. A few months after Reykjavik, Gorbachev invited Thatcher to visit Moscow in March of 1987. On February 27, 1987, she held a seminar with the UK's greatest experts on the Soviet Union to prepare. The experts informed her that there was no sign of adoption of market principles in the Soviet economy and no likelihood that Soviet ideology would change fundamentally. If anything, there would be only limited change which fully preserved the powers and guiding role of the party. The Foreign Office, which Thatcher had a lifelong disdain for, gave her two silver-handed hairbrushes as her official gift to Gorbachev, even though she pointed out the obvious fact that he was completely bald. Thatcher and Gorbachev got along very well when she got to Moscow, arguing for hours, but in an atmosphere of mutual admiration rather than mutual distrust. She walked with him in Red Square, waving to the Russians, who had been told for decades that they would never be allowed to leave their country. And now, a few meters away from where Lenin's preserved corpse remained on display, the woman who was the incarnation of petty bourgeois values was being chaperoned by the General Secretary of the Communist Party. Further, he was clearly signaling to the population that she was not someone to hate, but rather a friend to appreciate. For a woman who was excruciatingly proper, Margaret Thatcher still knew very well how to be seductive. In 1977, a couple of years before becoming prime minister, journalist Christopher Hitchens conceded an argument that he was having with her. "I gave her the point and made a slight bow of acknowledgement. She pierced me with a glance. 'Bow lower,' she commanded." "No, no, much lower." Having arranged matters to her entire satisfaction, she produced from her behind a rolled up parliamentary order paper and struck, no, she thwacked me on the behind. Similarly, longtime French President François Mitterrand is often quoted as saying that Thatcher possessed the eyes of Caligula and the mouth of Marilyn Monroe. But Mitterrand's aide Jacques Attali insisted that this was a misquote. Mitterrand had actually said her eyes were those of Stalin. It was that mouth and those eyes that were now trained on the Soviet people. In a move without precedent, Thatcher was interviewed for an hour on Soviet television by three Russian journalists. It was then aired unedited that same evening. Over 120 million people ended up watching The Iron Lady, although to be fair, it's not like there was much else on. When she had been leader of the opposition, the U.S. Embassy described Margaret Thatcher as frightfully English. Yet the imagery of a strong, forthright woman, secure in her opinions, able to put men in their place with her words and a glare, was something the Russian people were all too familiar with. It was Thatcher at her best, and her message was crystal clear. Over and over, she stuck to her point. "We both want, above all, peace," she insisted. "I value peace, with freedom and justice above everything else. And because at the moment, I believe that the nuclear deterrent stops anyone from starting a major war, I believe in keeping it." Acknowledging the enormous price the Soviet Union paid against Hitler and reminding the audience that for a time, Britain had to stand alone against the Nazi dictator, she pointed out how nuclear weapons kept Europe largely free of warfare for decades because the costs of a nuclear exchange would be incalculable. Thatcher also let the Russians know that it was the Soviet Union's deployment of intermediate range ballistic missiles that had caused missiles to be stationed in Western Europe, and that the USSR has a very good anti-ballistic missile defense system around Moscow, meaning SDI was neither a provocation nor without precedent. Neither of those things were known to the Soviet public before, and it was painfully obvious to the audience that Thatcher was being more honest about Soviet weaponry with them than their own leadership had been. When she flipped the script and asked one of the interviewers, "What do you think are the advantages of a socialist society?" they simply ignored her and moved on. To have this question go unanswered on Soviet television would have been impossible a few years prior. A few months after Thatcher's visit, Reagan planned a trip to West Berlin in order to deliver a speech for the city's 750th anniversary celebration. Drafts of his speech had gone back and forth between Reagan and his team, with one specific sentence causing major problems. "I really think that line is going to be an affront to Mr. Gorbachev," commented Secretary of State George Shultz. They were still going at it up to the morning of the speech. "I'm the president, right?" Reagan pointed out. "Then it stays in." Still, Reagan knew he was taking a risk. On January 12, 1987, as Reagan drove in the presidential limo to Berlin's famous Brandenburg Gate, he turned to his chief of staff, Ken Duberstein, and reiterated his decision. "The boys at state are going to kill me," he said, "but it's the right thing to do." Directly behind the Brandenburg Gate lurked the Berlin Wall and all that it symbolized. Reagan stood in front of an enormous crowd and an array of television cameras from all the world and issued his challenge. "General Secretary Gorbachev," he said, "if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." The audience erupted into hysterics. The East German authorities were livid and the Soviet ones not much better. What was seen in the West as a call of defiance was taken in Moscow as a challenge to Gorbachev personally and to the USSR specifically. Savvy minds on the far side of the Iron Curtain understood that if the Berlin Wall were torn down, then the entire communist system would likely be torn down with it. Because Reagan and Thatcher were both on the right wings of their respective nations' right-wing parties, there was no one to outflank them and accuse them of being doves who were soft against Soviet aggression. This allowed them a certain amount of freedom to do just that, focusing more on diplomacy than on hostility and bluster. Yet old habits have a way of dying hard. Though Gorbachev had far more institutional power than either the president or the prime minister, he still had to manage a gigantic, decades-old bureaucracy quite averse to change. He had to move craftily, assuring the old guard that the moves he was making would strengthen the Soviet Union. This, despite his publicly stating that the guilt of Stalin is enormous and unforgivable. And during the 70th anniversary of the